Most people go to the same old job every day, doing the same things every day, barely getting by. But it doesn't have to be that way. This is the real path to BYOB. Be your own boss. Change your life through real estate. On this show, we'll have interviews and inspiration from people who've made it, bringing you real life stories to help you chart your own path to BYOB. This is the real path to BYOB. Be your own boss. And now, here's your host, Mun Sachapuri.
Welcome back to another episode of The Real Path to BYOB, Be Your Own Boss, the show that aims to inspire you to achieve financial freedom and be your own boss. This is your host, Mun Sachapuri. Our guest for today's episode is Damian Lupo. Damian Lupo is the best-selling author of 12 books on personal finance, investment, and retirement planning. He hosts the Financial Underdogs podcast, has owned more than 50 companies, and is the founder of his own martial art, Aikido. Damian is also a professional investor with decades of real-world experience that started with the purchase of his first rental using a Visa card advance, a move that snowballed into 150 rental houses in less than 5 years. In 2008, he lost the whole $20 million business only to bounce back and recreate his wealth in 5 years. His mission is to free a million people from financial bondage. His unique tool is a fusion of financial literacy and a little-known strategy called EQRP that allows investors to control their retirement money and get off the Wall Street roller coaster. Welcome to the show, Damian. I'm so excited and honored to have you on our show. Great. Let's get started. So you started super early on your entrepreneurial journey, right? As young as 11 years is what I come to know. Share with us a little bit on what was the motivation, what attracted you to entrepreneurship?
Being poor sucks. And so when I was a kid, that's what I was told. We don't have any money. There's no money for anything. And I didn't like that answer. When you want something as a kid, two choices. One, you just accept that you're poor and probably you're screwed for life. Or you say, all right, I'm going to go fix it. I'm going to let the inner entrepreneur come out. And so I started businesses, and I was solving problems, which is what any entrepreneur should be doing. The thing that unfortunately too many people do is they say, how am I going to make $1 billion? I'm just going to go figure out this thing and take it public, or I'm going to go reverse merge into a SPAC or something. And all that type of mentality just leads to a very unsustainable burnout and really nothing that the world needs. It's when you find a problem and you go solve it, the money is a side effect. And I didn't know that at the time, but that's turned out to be extremely true and universally honest.
Got it. So what all different areas did you try, and how did you end up with real estate, and what do you do now?
I tried them all. I mean, it's kind of a funny answer, but everything from venture capital, real estate development, real estate investments, insurance companies. I had a car washing company, like all sorts of different things. I have a retirement plan company and a precious metals company now, as well as a financial literacy company and a hedge fund. So it's really across the board, because there's business skills when you develop them can be applied to other things. Most people don't have business skills. You have to develop them. People are afraid of it. Once you have them, you can't unlearn them, and they really are useful across the board. So that all those experiences led to the point where now I think, oh, this is fairly straightforward and theoretically easy, but anything looks easy. Like, you know, you look at Simone Biles do her gymnastics. Maybe that doesn't look easy, but it looks pretty effortless. And it's, yeah, okay, spend 15 years training 8 or 10 hours a day on anything. And that's what business is. So 50 companies is really good training. It's like a huge personal development program where you go bald in the process.
How did you find the idea? How did you find the money? Like, also another question is, like, you mentioned, like, growing poor was not something you liked, and that was the motivation behind all this, right? But typically growing up in a poor family with parents working a job also creates a situation where your parents just want you to study extremely well and get that secure job. Did you struggle with something like that?
I had the same focus for a lot of people. It was certain types of belief systems being beat into my head that we didn't have money, and to get security, it was security, security, security. So go out, get a college education. I got thrown out of college a couple of times. And so that obviously didn't work. Even after I had over 100 rental houses, I remember a conversation with my dad where he said, when are you going to go back to college and get a degree? And I said, why would I do that? And he said, well, because then you can get a pension with the government. I said, Dad, I've got like $9 million of real estate. He's like, I don't understand what you do. He was so focused on the government security thing that that was the programming. And so he didn't get that I was effectively retired. I was way too egotistical. So it wasn't sustainable. My ego led to the crash, my crash. I didn't cause the recession, but I caused my own recession. And so when I lost the $20 million and went to negative multi-millions, I needed to do that. I needed to go through that process. And then I reinvented. And now there's a sustainability around what I'm doing. But I just don't accept somebody telling me how something is or how it's not. I refuse to buy into somebody's BS, if you will. And I think, unfortunately, most people don't challenge. They lose the curiosity, which is, you know, when you think about being a kid, you're curious about everything. And I don't buy into this idea that just because you're from the ghetto or the hood, that you're stuck. I think a lot of people use that as a crutch. And I go, look, everybody, I don't care if you're on food stamps, everybody's got a smartphone. Like everybody, you could be homeless. There's homeless people on the corner of the street that have smartphones. Like, okay, everybody's got a smartphone. So if you have a smartphone, you have the whole world's information. So it's not like you can say, well, I didn't know. No, it's what you can say is I didn't ask a question. Because unless you have mental issues, and some people do, most people complain that are victims don't have mental issues. They have mental inertia. They just gave up thinking. They stopped. But the reality is everybody can go make choices. And they do that by saying, okay, what's out there? How do I get rich? How do I get free? What could I learn? I mean, every possible thing to learn is on the internet right now. There, I mean, you know, in Austin, if you want to learn a new skill in tech, there is a coding school somewhere and there's so much free. So it's really just a choice. People think you have to be born into it or go to Harvard or whatever. All you have to have is a little bit of initiative, motivation, and go.
The drive, right. Yes. Awesome. Very well said. So you mentioned a good point, like when you lost the $20 million and you had to bounce back up, like you just believed in yourself. Like how did you bounce back up? How did you even face that?
I went through a process where I pretended that it didn't happen because it's so painful. When you think you are your balance sheet, if you have whatever you have, you have $1 million, $2 million, and that's your life, the money, then when that goes away, your identity is gone because your self-worth and net worth are so entangled. They're one and the same. So I just pretended it didn't happen. Finally, it took me a year and a half, 2 years. And then I said, okay, this is a problem because I'm negative money. I have no credit cards. I couldn't afford to buy a toaster oven because nobody would give me credit for it. Like it was a mess. And so at that point, I said, okay, I need help. And this is something that we all need all the time, no matter what, forever. Like you think about people that say, well, I don't need help. I don't need a mentor. I mean, Bill Gates has a mentor. His name is Warren Buffett. I mean, give me a break. He's one of the richest people in the world, most successful, and he has a mentor. So mentors are important. When you think you don't need a mentor, you're about to have an experience called getting your ass kicked.
Yeah, it's learned the hard way through your own experience, or use someone's experience and learn it in a much easier way, right? Yeah, I can relate to that. Yes.
That's a fact. And there's also something to be said about learning by doing things, because you can't learn everything from somebody else's stuff. That's like saying, I am a master because I've read 4,000 books. No, you're not. You're just intellectually savvy, but you're probably an idiot in real practice. So the truth is, you have to go learn things. Do you need to do everything wrong like everybody else? No, go make up some new mistakes. Then you could write a new book on new mistakes. Don't make all the same mistakes everybody else makes. That's insanity. That's wasting your life energy.
Right. So during that phase, you went and picked a mentor who could help you with the mindset to be able to handle your loss and then come back up with a different business plan. What did you do in that phase?
Yeah, ironically, it was when I was in Austin, and it was a guy named Frank. We spent a year and a half asking one question. The question is, what is true? It's the basis for my book, Reinvented Life, asking that question, what is true? And then you keep asking and you go deeper and deeper, because when you first say, oh, this is what's true, like, who am I? What is true? Here's what it is. And then you go deeper and you find, as you go deeper, there's a deeper and deeper belief systems with deeper consequences around those belief systems that are baked in, and you get to your cell, like the cellular level, there's belief systems. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really crazy is that if you think about some people that hoard things, and you're like, why would you hoard things? You know, you do well, you make money. What is it? And oftentimes what you'll find is a cellular memory from the Great Depression. And that's because when something is so traumatic, it bakes those experiences into the cells and to the chromosomes. Ultimately, that gets passed along as a genetic memory. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what's going to happen with the pandemic. We're going to have all this trauma that people are going to have in their cells. And so generations from now, people are going to be doing things. Maybe they'll like, I don't know why I need to wear a mask, but I feel like I do, because there was so much fear and anxiety around living that people did these things. So it's really acknowledging that those things are baked in and then putting them right in front of you. And you can say, do I want this or not? And then developing some type of physical process to countermeasure them. Otherwise, by default, you're always going to be a representation of your past beliefs.
Very, very interesting. So to add that on a spiritual note, like based on what I read, like we all have this evolutionary memory, right? And the evolutionary memory is what helps us survive. It's meant to like protect us, and survival is the most primary aspect of our existence. And that's what kicks in and reflects in little minor things from the way we eat. When people eat more, it's because it's a survival instinct. Like you're thinking that maybe there won't be more food, but now actually the main cause of disease is overeating, eating more than you need to. So that survival mechanism reflects in everything that we do, starting from what we eat, how we eat, to big things like how we manage money. So it's really interesting that you mentioned that when we go through a trauma, it just gets wired into ourselves. And then even without realizing, you are acting upon that past memory. So what did you do? Or could you share with us a little bit about your realization that helped you overcome that? And what are the measures that you actively had to take?
Well, yeah, I mean, the first one is I just realized I was a total asshole. And I said, okay, well, that's, you know, that's something to acknowledge. Because I looked back and I said, what's true? I was doing things because I was driving towards significance. I needed to have significance. It's one of the basic human needs. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have something that's giving you significance, then you're going to find something, and it may not be very healthy. And so you'll do all sorts of things. And then you'll do things if you don't understand security, because that's another one of those basic human needs. Mm-hmm. If you don't understand that, then, I mean, part of security, it's not just living, it's not just surviving, it's like procreating. Like sex is a thing that it may be more powerful than our own lives, because people will, I mean, you look at some animals in nature, and they'll have sex and die. Like mm-hmm. that's because they're trying to propagate the species. And so we do things, and if we're not conscious to it, we're basically animals running from our amygdala. And so it's that primal part of our brain that's driving things. It's not very enlightened. It's very basic level of the of Maslow's
primal
hierarchy.
Needs. Yeah.
Totally primal.
Not so, the higher self where you could go because of the developed brain that we have as a human.
That's it. Most people don't think about this. They're just literally in survival mode. And then they're in this FOMO mode, which is also kind of a survival mode. When you think about social media, we're just running and chasing things because why do we do that? Why do we go and say, well, I need to be like this? I see somebody else with this thing. Why do I need to be like that? If you ask yourself, why is that? And the reason it is because we have a tribal instinct, because in a mm-hmm. tribe, in a group of people, you're going to have a higher likelihood of surviving, not getting eaten by something. If you're on the outskirts and you're like this person that doesn't match or fit in with anything, you get eaten by a lion. It's totally baked into our system. And so that's one of the reasons that when we chase things on social media, we're constantly feeling like we're going to die. And so we get addicted to it. That addiction is a survival.
Interesting. Yeah, it just amazes me how the little things that we do without being conscious to it is all grounded in this survival and how our brains have evolved, the primal instincts. It's crazy. Think about it. So what did you change about your mindset going forward, like starting your next business after? How did you approach that?
I approached it with a problem in mind that I was going to solve. And the problem was based on a mission. So that there's, when I looked at my bubble, my life, I started off with my parents. My parents both retired and they didn't have resources. My dad died saying, I wish I would have done more. That was my last conversation with him. He said there were so many things that I wanted to do a few weeks before he died. And it was because he didn't have the resources and he didn't go deep. And so that hit me and I said, I'm going to help people not have that conversation. I'm going to start by making sure I never have that conversation. So that evolved into a mission. And a mission has to be about more of something than money. It can't just be, my mission is to have a whole bunch of money. But why? You want a bunch of dead, you know, pieces of paper with dead presidents on it? Like, why do you want all this money? And instead of asking, how can I get more money? The question is, how can I get more impact? How can I give more? How can I create more? the money ends up being a side effect. So instead of me saying, I'm going to go make another $100,000 in real estate deals, I said, how can I go break more financial shackles? What we have now is we have modern day slavery. So what we do is financial emancipation. We literally go out there and break shackles. And that's a mission that creates a lot of freedom, and it creates wealth for the people that we serve and for the company and for us. People do this backwards. They literally say it's like charity. People, you probably heard people say this. Well, if I make $1 million, I will definitely give away $100,000. And I say, no, you don't. No, you won't. And they say, yeah. I go, what? How much are you making now? Like $100,000. How much are you giving away? $400. I'm like, you're not going to do more when it's harder then. So it's the same thing as looking at a fireplace and saying, you know what? As soon as you give me heat, I'll give you some wood. Like, it doesn't work like that. You got to go out and get the wood. You put it in there, and then you get the heat. It's the same thing. I mean, people do things in reverse order, but what happens is nothing happens because you don't get heat first. And it's the same thing with anything, whether it's business or investing. People throw money at investments, wonder why their money goes away. It's because you didn't do the research. You didn't actually evolve as a human being. You don't understand what you're investing in. Too anxious. It's like a very primal, stupid emotion of anxiety and fear.
Interesting. So you pretty much changed your entire philosophy on like serving people and for the greater good and put the money as a secondary aspect. Like, what was money consideration still?
So I'm not smart enough to come up with this stuff. Buckminster Fuller talks about the 90-degree effect of purpose and money. The money is a side effect. It's a 90-degree effect. It comes from the bee. That if you look at a bee, it goes out and it goes and it's like, oh, I'm gonna go do this honey thing. And what happens as a side effect is that it cross-pollinates all the flowers and all the food. And that's so the bee actually has this thing that the universe had in mind. The bee doesn't know that it's doing that. It's like doing its thing. It's like going over to the flower. And what we tend to be is we tend to be money bees. We're like focusing on money. And that's not our purpose. Nobody's purpose on this planet is to go get money. That is like the dumbest thing for anybody to be taught. It does not mean that money is bad. In fact, I love money. Yeah. And it's my God, but I love it. And you've probably seen these things where people have these programs where they say, I'm a money magnet, and they've watched The Secret and all this nonsense. Just because you say that doesn't mean anything. You have to live it. You have to actually go in there and say, okay, what am I going to do that's going to help other people? It's not altruistic where I say, I'm just going to help people and be Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm, and there's an agenda. I have an agenda to do this. It's satisfying my purpose. And everybody has something. It's not for, you said for the greater good. I think there's an interesting thing around the greater good. This is for people's self-interest. Like, why would somebody want to do something with me? Because in their self-interest, they don't want to be a slave.
Right.
And we are all slaves if we don't understand money. We will always be slaves. I don't care if you have millions of dollars in the bank. You're always going to be a slave if you don't get money and you don't have it working for you. Otherwise, you're just money's bitch.
Yeah. Very well said. Wow. You said a lot of things that went, okay, wow, amazing. It's a lot of things to digest about money and the mindset and stuff. So what do you do currently? Share a little bit about that.
So, I mean, what I spend my days doing is putting energy and love into my team. My team ends up serving our clients, serving people, breaking those shackles. And we do that by giving people control of their retirement money. One of the most dangerous or scariest things is the idea that you're going to wake up one day and be out of money. You're going to be retired and no money. And so people, it doesn't matter if people have a million or two. Wall Street tells you if you just have $2.3 million, then you could live off that. And they have this formula. They are full of crap. Literally, they are liars, lying to you. And so we go out there and tell people the truth. Here's the truth. You have to build the muscle. I don't care if you have $10 million. If you don't build the muscle, you're going to lose the $10 million. There were people that had $100 million with Bernie Madoff. They had no financial muscle. They went from $100 million, richest top echelon in the United States. Mm-hmm. They went to zero overnight, to zero. They had no muscle. They were naive and arrogant around being wealthy. They weren't wealthy. They were just rich.
Because all the money is controlled by the 401k and like the financial institutions, and they really had no clue what was going on with that. Why did that happen?
They thought that they were brilliant because they had a big number in an account.
Okay.
There was no depth. They were not being good stewards of their money. They just handed it over to somebody and they didn't actually ask any questions. Like, how does somebody get 12% per year for 40 years? Not possible.
I think that's really relevant today with a lot of folks with like stressful, you know, hectic jobs in tech and lawyers, doctors who get big paychecks, but don't have the time to really invest in financial literacy and expect their 401ks to be managed. So that's a very relevant point. Like, what do you suggest in that case? Like, the time management and, you know, with limited time, how does someone make this balance of still being able to take care of their retirement account and becoming financially independent?
I love that you said that, because there is no managing time. They're spending it. You can't manage it. You just literally spend it. So the question is, what do you spend it on? And it's like people that say, I'm going to save some time. I'm like, you can't save time. Like, what, are you crazy? How do you save time? Show me a pile of time you saved.
It's like, always ticking away.
You spend it. Yeah. I mean, we're not in a fifth dimension yet. Like, maybe, like, if you watch a really great Matthew McConaughey movie, I mean, you're in Austin, but you think about, you've got to spend your time. So what do people that are financially free spend their time doing? Investing in their financial education. They understand how to have money work for them. They understand Warren Buffett's philosophy that if you don't have money working while you're asleep, then you are never going to be free. You'll work until the day you die. And that's what people understand. So how do you understand that? You go and you get educated, not with an MBA, not with, you know, it's not in school. School is not going to teach. School is going to teach you how to be a slave. Like, go get a job, work until you're dead. And that's kind of the process. Schools don't teach this stuff. You got to go out there, and that's where seminars, that's where mentors, masterminds, that's where all that stuff comes into play. And it's the most powerful thing. People will say, I can't spend $5,000 for a weekend. I'm like, why? Spend $150,000 on 4 years that got you what? A job? Go spend $5,000 in a weekend and watch somebody tell you how this is the formula. I did that. I remember my first weekend. I spent about $5,000 on tapes. Like, this was in January 2000. $5,000 in tapes. That thing made me tens of millions of dollars. No college degree is going to make you tens of millions of dollars in less than 10 years.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're a neurosurgeon. It's just not going to happen. So it's really rethinking how you learn, how you program, what you do, who you surround yourself with.
So what are some of, like, the very, like, basic resources that you would recommend for someone to go and take those first baby steps to learn about, you know, all this different stuff on becoming, on just educating themselves?
Easiest one that I'd love suggesting is go play Robert Kiyosaki's board game Cashflow.
Okay.
It's online. It's free.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know, go play it. And it's even better if you play it in, you know, you may have to play with masks with your friends, but play the game. Play it not once. Play it dozens of times. I've played it hundreds of times, because you'll see, you'll learn. So when you think about saving time or managing time or all that stuff, if you play a game, it's the closest thing to doing the thing. And so if you're like, oh, I don't understand money, play the game. You'll learn about money and how you think about money and how you operate around money. In a matter of 3 hours, you'll accelerate yourself 3 years. I mean, that's how fast that thing is. Maybe 30 years, because some people are in perpetual Groundhog Day on a merry-go-round.
Awesome. I mean, that's a great suggestion. I've heard about the game. I spend a lot of time educating myself through podcasts and books, but I've never played the game. So I probably have to do that very soon. So thank you for that. Moving on, like, you wrote 12 books, right? And the one that caught my attention, which also in your bio, you mentioned that's what you currently educate people on, EQRP. Could you share with me and my viewers what exactly is that and how one can benefit from that if they are working with a big company with a traditional 401k? How does one take advantage of that?
Well, the EQRP gives you access to and control of your retirement money. Whenever you leave jobs, you always have a choice of what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. When you're still at a job, you have less options. And that's on purpose, because companies want to lock up resources and there's a fee structure. And so companies make a lot of money with that. The great thing about when you leave, and like in your space, in the tech space, people leave a lot. And so they have all these 401ks floating around. You can control all that money. And there are good ways to do it. And then there are stupid ways to do it. The stupidest one is to roll it into an IRA or a self-directed IRA, because it's limiting. The better choice is an EQRP, because you actually have control of it. You can do things like invest in real estate, invest in gold, invest in Bitcoin, invest in businesses, tech startups, early angel stuff. Like, you can do damn near anything and you're in control. And it can grow with you. So you go, this is cool. I want to be an entrepreneur now. And then you hire some people. Awesome. Your EQRP keeps growing with you and your company. Like, it's really cool to be able to have that type of control. And then you realize, wow, there's ways I can do this where I'm never going to pay taxes again. So when people got really pissed off at Donald Trump, it was mostly communists. They were like, oh, he's not paying taxes. Like, he's using the tax code, you ding dong. Go out and use the tax code. It's written for everybody, but most people don't read it. So what do? They're cheap. Most people's problem is not that they're stupid. It's that they're cheap. They're smart, but they're cheap. So many people are like, I'm going to just do my own taxes. I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to have a cheap, my accountant only cost me $500. I'm like, you're an idiot. You're going to get idiot advice. No world-class tax strategist costs $500. They're thousands of dollars. And what do you get for that? No taxes, or a lot less taxes. Like, it's unbelievable how people will be cheap and they think it saves them money. It's like hiring an employee that's not a great, an A player. That's expensive. Hire an A player. Doesn't matter how much you pay them because it makes the company money. So you have to, but it's more of a spiritual abundance. People are, they're taught to live in scarcity. We're taught to have a either or, win, lose, Malthusian economics, limited resources, nonsensical approach to life. We know that that's not true. I mean, if you have any type of faith, you realize there's abundance. Mm-hmm. And when you actually understand economics, you're like, that Malthusian guy was a moron. There's just an abundance. And if you buy into that, you realize, wow, I don't need to actually hurt anybody in this process. We can all win.
So I have a quick follow-up question. So saving on taxes, do you think for someone with a traditional job and just maybe a little bit of investing on the side, going for professional tax advice would still be beneficial? Or is it a trade-off that they just have to figure out?
No, here's one of the reasons. You're going to go in and you're going to talk to a tax advisor and the good ones, like the great ones. Forget about the good ones. Good ones, don't even hire the good ones. Get great ones.
Okay.
Hire people that are beyond where you are, where you're going to go. You don't hire an accountant that is right with you. You want somebody that's beyond that, that's working with people that are beyond you. Here's what they're going to tell you. As an employee, you're basically screwed. You're going to get the most taxed in our tax system. And a great tax strategist is going to say, well, could we do some other things? Could we start a side hustle? Could we do some real estate? Could we start shifting some of your income? Could you become a contractor to your company? All these things are going to come up. But if you go to somebody that you pay $500 to file your tax return, they're not going to say crap to you. They're literally just going to say, okay, here's your tax return. And guess what? Congratulations, you got a refund, you moron. Like, that's what they're going to give you.
Okay. I see the difference. It's about where you want to be versus where you are. Okay. Makes sense.
They're gonna help you get there. A strategist does it. If you think about most accountants, they're like coroners. They do autopsies on what happened. Whereas a tax strategist is more like, they're like a fortune teller. Like, okay, well, we're going to look into the future. You want that person. You don't want the coroner doing an autopsy. Like, that's morbid. That's terrible.
Yeah, makes sense. It's all about where you want to be financially than just planning for the current right now kind of a thing. Yeah.
There's a slight shift. People can say, well, I want to be rich or I want to be at this place. Well, until you're committed, you're not going to actually commit the money. So if you just want something, nobody cares. If you're committed, then they're paying attention. It's called providence. It's around divine intervention. When you commit to something, until you commit, nothing happens. When you commit, you have all acts of providence. There's a great poem around that everybody should go look up. Providence will happen to the universe.
Could you repeat that? Sorry, I think you broke up there.
Yeah. So when you commit to something, there's a great poem, and I think it was by Goethe, and it basically says that once you commit to something, all acts of divine providence ensue. Basically, the universe conspires with you. All sorts of resources show up, and people think, this is so hard. I'm like, it's so hard because you're so not committed. Once you commit, watch what happens. Also, it's like magic. And that's not the secret. That's literally the universe. The secret, this idea that you can say, I want a bag of money to hit me in the head. It doesn't work like that. But once you commit to something, you say, I'm focused. Guess what? People are going to start. When you say that to somebody, here's what I'm doing. I'm not doing 14 things. Here's what I'm doing. It's this one thing. People go, oh, they start paying attention. So what happens is their reticular activator gets triggered by somebody else that they notice. And like, oh, you know what? I can connect you. People start doing things like that because you've given them something to focus on. Just like when you buy a car and you see all those cars on the road, it's the same thing. People will start becoming a filter for you as a car. They're like, oh, I got another person I should connect you to.
Interesting. That kind of resonates with a saying I heard, like when you put your energy on something that grows, like whatever you focus on, your attention on, that grows. So like really you're saying just focus on one thing and then like let it grow.
Yeah.
Really commit. Okay.
Quite frankly, most people's mistake is that they're doing too many things. You shouldn't be doing, you should be doing one thing. And people say, well, I need to diversify. And I'm like, who is telling you this crap? Dave Ramsey? Stop listening to him. I know if you're in a ton of debt, probably a good idea to listen to him for a second. The truth is they don't want to focus because they're afraid of missing out. This FOMO thing is killing people.
Yes. And with social media, like distracted attention spans, people are everywhere.
We have become a bunch of drunk squirrels chasing shiny nuts. Like it's the craziest thing. People wonder why they're not getting any traction. It's because they're spinning out in 14 different directions. Ask somebody what they're doing. What do you got going on? I'm like, this and this and this and this. And I'm a real estate investor and I've got a business I'm starting up and I'm selling Cutco knives and I'm doing this other thing and I'm mowing lawns and I'm painting houses and I've got two jobs and I'm bartending. It's like, Good God. So what's your next step? Stop doing most of the things you're doing.
Well, so on that note, right, you yourself have experimented with 50 businesses. How did you navigate that? That sounds like a lot. Like you would have done a lot at some point. So how did that, did you do a lot at some point and then realize that's not the way to go and then started focusing your attention? How did that all span out?
So the ones that didn't work, that failed, were the ones that were done simultaneous when there were multiple things going on that didn't have any momentum. Like if you look at Richard Branson, he's got 50, 100, 200, 500 companies, some crazy number. Does he run any of them? No. He has people. Did he start all of them at once? No. He started one thing. And it's the same thing. You start one thing. So I've had a lot of companies. Some have worked. When did they work? When I was focusing on them. When they didn't work is when I had random companies that were getting a little bit of my attention here and there. And then people say, well, I'm a multitasker. And I'm like, no, you're not. You're a fast flipper. You flip from one thing to the next. And it takes time to engage it. And it's the difference between having a contractor, like a bookkeeper that does the books for 50 different people, or you have somebody that does just your stuff. Totally different thing, because they're thinking about your stuff all the time and they go deeper into your stuff. They can give you insights. The person that does 50 people's books, they're going to make mistakes. They're not really going to give you any insight. You're barely going to get your stuff accurate.
Right.
So it's a different thing when you think about focus. As fast as you can get focused and have other people focus on your stuff, the better you're going to be.
Yeah, kind of quality versus quantity, right? You really want to like get that maximum quality with your attention focused on it. I want to finish up with EQRP. So could someone have both the 401k and EQRP as well? Or is it just one?
There's no limit. You can have as many as you want.
Okay. And is there like an annual contribution limit?
So typically with EQRPs and 401ks, all of them are blobbed into a total of 58,000 annual contribution combined. So if you did 10,000 here and maybe 25,000 there, there are some exceptions to that where like some doctors or people that are consulting, they might work with a bunch of different companies where they're actually getting a W-2 for 10 different companies. We've seen people contribute $200,000-$400,000 a year into retirement accounts. It's because they were structured. Typically though, there's an aggregate, a combined number. It's 58,000 per person. So if you have a spouse, it could be 58,000. If you have kids, you could be another 58,000 per person. Kids are great because you can get a deduction by paying them, and then they can put that in their own account. And oftentimes it's zero tax completely all the way around. So there's a lot of options in this space.
Got it. So like a traditional provider like Fidelity Investments, where, you know, typically 401k for most or some tech companies is like with, they also have EQRP. Is it something like you go and find out? How does that work?
So the EQRP, we're the only ones, the EQRP company that I run is the only company in the country that does it. Everybody else does generic 401ks or individual 401ks, or they do things that are they're limited, or they just limit you. Like you can never have a part-time employee, or you can only do mutual funds, or you've got a custodian. The EQRP doesn't have any of that. You can do whatever you want. You can have employees. You control your money. You can invest into almost anything you feel like you want to. So it's a totally different thing. Fidelity is never going to even know they're not going to know what an EQRP is. They're going to say 401k, IRA.
Okay. So is that something that always existed, but not a lot of big like retirement planning service providers have it? Or is it something that you came up with? Like I'm a little confused on this concept of how it evolved.
So it came up because we took years ago, I took the tax code and figured out what you could actually do. And I realized that Wall Street was screwing people by giving them limited options. Why would they do that? Because the fees around mutual funds and stocks are really high. If Wall Street said, oh, okay, well, let's set up company 401ks and let people invest in real estate, they couldn't make money off of it. So they limited it. And so this has been around for almost 50 years. It started off in 1973. So this has been around a long time. The EQRP was developed in the last decade. I developed that. That's my baby. And we did that because people were being screwed out of their options to be able to be financially free. And I said, this is crazy. So, I mean, it's a bona fide IRS approved retirement account, and we're the only ones that do it. Everybody else is trying to keep people trapped and enslaved with stocks.
Got it. Interesting. So with this, like real estate is it's like totally eligible for real estate investing to take out the money at any time.
Rental property. We have people doing land all over the world, doing coffee farms and antique farms and orange trees in Ecuador and Panama. They're doing apartment buildings, mini storage, you name it. People are doing it. They're investing in Bitcoin. They're investing in physical gold. Like it's almost unlimited.
Got it. Very interesting. I'm sure like I'll try to get resources from you at the end of our conversation or interview to learn more about this. I want to navigate a little bit from this topic onto your real estate experience. Do you do real estate now, or was it something in the past?
So I do. I mean, I have a hedge fund that part of the focus is on real estate. And what we're finding, because I've done so much real estate and I've lost money, a lot of money in real estate, I'm very skeptical of every deal. Any professional investor is always skeptical before they decide to do a deal. A professional looks at a deal and says, this is a bad deal until proven otherwise. And so most of what's happening is most of the deals that are floating around there, the vast majority of them are bad deals. Just period, they're bad deals. Why? Because there's too much money chasing them. And it's creating a bubble in almost everything. There, if you look at whether it doesn't matter if it's mini storage or if it's apartments or it's houses, there's just a bubble. Why? Because there's too much money chasing stuff and there's a limited amount of supply. So that's basic economics. I mean, if you want to understand why it's going up, too much resource, too much money chasing too little resources and too much government in the way.
Yeah. So that's not your primary focus. You're more focused on EQRP.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we have to learn how to be business owners and investors. And so I've got my skills and talents and I've got teams and that's what I think everybody needs to really learn how to do is be a good business owner, be a good investor. And if you say, well, I'm an employee and I don't know how to do any of that stuff. Yeah. Join the club. It's a process.
Yeah.
It's not like work, that skill.
For sure. Yeah. It is a process. So the process being like, you first need to invest your money and then develop a business, right? So it's quite far out for a lot of folks.
You know, you can. I think one of the greatest things right now, especially right now, is to develop your business skills by doing business. Right. So if you have a job, great. Go figure out some side thing. You're going to learn a ton from that process, and you're going to be more empowered to eventually maybe make that your full time thing, where you're just running and building your own business. It's you can do investing and running a business at the same time. Like what people say, what do I do? I've got mutual funds. I'm like, great. Do something outside of that. Well, what do I do? I don't know. Go buy an ounce of silver. Start there. Super easy, $30. Like it's not very complicated to get started, but people say, I need to know all of the maneuvers. I need to know the whole chess game. Yeah, good luck on that one. That's not how it works.
You learn as you go, is it? And then find mentors along the way to help you and guide you in the right path.
Exactly.
Got it. Awesome. I mean, I'm sure you've had a lot of experience with your 50 companies. Who were the most influential people in your path during this whole time?
Probably all the people that hurt me the most, because we tend to remember the pain. It's like when you take a test and the ones you get wrong, you're like, what happened there? And you learn from that. Success is a terrible teacher. So we can say, the person that loved me, it's like, yeah, okay, that's something. But there's a great teacher in the pain. And so I would say the people that, you know, the partners that screwed me over, just the people that were, that I hired poorly because I was a poor boss, you know, people that I, so there's a lot of that. The mentors in my life have been incredibly useful and powerful because they challenged. And the one that I had in Austin, I mean, he was a coach, therapist, mentor. There were so many things about him because he reflected back. What I don't think is that anybody is your guru. Tony Robbins has an entire thing about that. I am not your guru. And the point is, you are your own guru. Sometimes you just don't know what questions to ask. You don't know where to go. And so having somebody that can ask you questions is what you should be looking for in a mentor.
Very interesting perspective. So, and the answers come from you, from insight, of your own consciousness.
There's a super consciousness that we can tap into if those questions get posed. It's amazing. Ask somebody what they know and they say, I have no idea. I don't know what I know. Ask them a pointed question and they're like, and then all of a sudden it's like vomit all over you. Like, stop talking. You got too much. It's really just about triggering it.
Yeah. Awesome. So could you share with us like an example of how, you know, you said people who hurt you have actually helped you grow and have been influential, right? Could you share with us like an example from the past of how that has played out?
Well, I mean, there's when you have, for example, if you have a partner, let's say, I mean, people will often go into partnership and they'll give up pieces of their company because they feel inadequate or they feel insecure. And so somebody will say, I want a piece. And then you say, okay, you can have it. I mean, I did that with one partner and I gave this woman, like, it was half the company. And I realized she was there to cheerlead. I'm like, you don't deserve half the damn company for cheerleading. And then we said, okay, well, let's make it 40%. And I was like, you don't deserve 4%. You're not creating any value. So I've learned that for somebody to own something, they need to be creating value and they need to actually contribute something, capital, something. It's what did I learn? I learned that my own inadequacies, my own insecurity was the reason that I was willing to do that. And so when you see how people will take advantage of it, you realize everybody has an agenda. So just be honest about what the agenda is. Doesn't mean partners are bad. I have a great partner now, world class, trust him with my life. And there's a mutual respect there. What I realized is there was no mutual respect in the past with partners. And so that's a great example of, do you need a partner or do you need a dog or do you need an employee? Like, what do you actually need if you're going to have a business? And people tend, I should have just got a dog. I needed somebody that would just be loyal. And so, but instead I gave up half of a company, and I've done that a couple of times. And I did, it took me, I'm not smart enough to learn the first time. So I have to do it again sometimes. So that.
It's a super, super interesting you mentioned that, because I guess like as business owners, and I mean, you being a business owner, and for someone like who wants to start their own business, like you learn a lot and you think very logically about a lot of aspects, but there is the human emotional aspect, which can drive a lot of important decisions. So I guess what you mentioned comes back to that, right? It's the emotional side making the decision instead of the logical side, which maybe you even knew like someone wasn't adding value, but it was the emotional like decision making that came into picture in that case. So do you ever experience that, the conflict between like the logical side and the emotional side, trying to make different decisions? And how did that play when you like try to bring them both into like a synchronicity to finally come to get clarity on which is the best way to go?
So being clear and having power in the clarity is that's great. Ultimately, we always have imperfect information. And so you eventually have to use emotion. You have to use instincts. And the problem in the beginning is you don't have any instincts because you don't have any experience. And so you're just guessing. You're just like, okay, well, on this spreadsheet, this looks like a good thing, but you don't have any instincts. After having, when I lost a couple of $1 million in an apartment, I was like, oh, all those things that I was doing, I was trying to make people happy. I was a pleaser of people. And I mean, there was one kid I hired in Austin. I mean, the stories for him are endless. The guy ripped me off. He stole intellectual property, launched a company because that's what people do. And so I learned that. I'm like, okay, well, I need to be really smart about who I let get close to me and the decisions I'm making. There's no way to learn that stuff. You end up with wisdom, which is, that's how you go bald too. Bald, gray. You know, I always say, if a mentor should be somebody bald or grayer than you, not somebody, you can learn from people that are younger than you. But the difference with somebody that's older is, especially 10, 20 years older, is you, or has 10, 20, 30 years more experience, is that they have scar tissue. So when you're going through something, they can see way into the future, and within seconds, they can say, here's what's coming. And you would go, wow, how do you know that? Because I've lived through hell and I'm still here. And that's the difference.
Interesting. Wow. That is very interesting. Another thing I wanted to ask you is, you said you started 50 companies and learned a lot from them through the experience and everything. Was there ever fear? Because one thing that the human mind holds on to is fear, right? Like we all hold on to bad experiences and we imagine worst case scenarios because we don't want that to repeat. So in your case, did that ever play any role? Like, did you fear that something bad would happen when you kept on going and things were not working out always like you had anticipated? And especially when you had that big fall back, losing $20 million. Was fear a big block in your life?
There's always a fear around failure until you get so experienced at failing that you just stop really caring. When I had my job in Alaska and I had to dodge polar bears, if I failed at that job, I died because I was eaten by a bear. So what I've realized is that there's nothing that's going to eat me. And when we really think about it, nothing's going to eat us. What are we going to do? We're going to grow. We're going to get stronger. We're going to have more wisdom. And so then the question is, well, I'm going to do something new. I've got to make decisions. I still have this fear. How do I get around that? Do I not have fear? I'm too busy in action and in motion. You cannot be in action and motion and still be afraid. Consciously, there's something about being in movement. And so when you're making decisions and you're moving to the next thing, I'm making thousands of decisions, probably thousands of decisions a week. Just all these decisions, there's no time to mull. People that are stuck in their lives are too busy thinking about their lives. They're not actually doing their lives. They're not living in them. They're just observing them.
But aren't the decisions affected by the fear, the background fear in the brain?
Depends on how fast you can. The people that have the biggest problem with fear oftentimes are the most analytical. And that can be challenging because you think, and it doesn't mean thinking is bad. It means that oftentimes just the thinking, you'll stay in a perpetual state of thinking. And then it's like, well, all the things that could go wrong. Hey, let me give you a little hint. Things go wrong. Mm-hmm. Shit happens. Like, it's just life. And so when you realize that, you go, okay, well, so I'm going to learn as much as I can, as quickly as I can, and make a decision. It's not about perfect information anymore. It's about how fast you can make a decision and then adapt to the changes. Like, how many people, in early 2020 had a plan for 2020. I went to a goals type of event in December of 2019, had a huge plan for 2020, had all these trips and all these conventions. And within 60 days, the plan was obliterated and a massive pivot had to happen. And the year ended up being much better than even planned. And it was because we adapted, pivoted, grew. What most people did is they freaked out. They said, oh my gosh, my plan is not going to be the same. And then they froze. And that's, unfortunately, that's why a lot of people got stuck, because they didn't say, what could I do differently? And then do it.
Okay. So be more like realistic, go with the flow of the situation than being stuck to an idea and holding on to that fear.
It's being pragmatic and being practical about what's actually happening is a huge advantage. I see a lot of people that are stuck in saying, I've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, Bitcoin, it's a great example. Mm-hmm, that's just crazy. And that's going to zero. And I go, I'm pretty sure you're addicted to your past. You have a cognitive bias towards the past. And it's going to keep people oblivious to the changes that are going on. Our monetary system, everything is changing globally. It is completely changing. There is going to be a war between centralized and decentralized currencies. And all of the financial systems are being attacked by this system, because the financial systems suck a lot. They literally take from you, and they have been forever. And what's happening is all these different protocols and platforms are saying, we can do this better. We can do it more honest. And there's going to be a war. But when you have decentralized stuff, it's a little hard to stop it. You're not going to turn off the internet. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, ultimately, freedom is going to win.
I mean, I want to like capture the final message from all the conversation. What should someone do to put fear in the back burner and be able to make the best decision without any influence of that?
I mean, ultimately, it's about doing the things where you have an experience. Once you have experience, you have something to let, it gives you some type of backbone and foundation. And so you say, well, I don't know anything about gold. I don't know anything about stocks. I don't know anything about Bitcoin. So I'm afraid of them. I'm afraid I'm going to lose money. One of my friends said, well, how do I invest in Bitcoin and not be afraid of buying into the tulip bubble? And I said, go buy some Bitcoin. He's like, it's like, what? Wait, but you just do the thing you're afraid of in spite of it. You literally say, okay, well, I'm going to go do the thing. It doesn't mean you go transfer your net worth, but you know what? Go buy $1,000 of Bitcoin. Okay. You tend to pay attention to the things you pay for. And that's the summary. You will pay attention to things that you have energy invested in. Energy in the form of money. All money is energy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Bitcoin. What is Bitcoin? It's a network that is a transference of energy. And so what are dollars? Fake crap that powerful people put together. There's no scarcity there, and there's no energy transfer. When you can just say click, 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 and there's $4 trillion, that is not, that's a fraud. We're being ripped off by the system, completely being stolen from. People are protesting, but they don't know. And I get they're protesting about whatever they're protesting about. What they're missing is that they're being screwed over by the monetary system, the central banks. And so ultimately, if you invest, if you put your energy, which most people have actually earned the money, like they've transferred their time and sweat into dollars or yen or euros or Venmo or something. When you take that and you put it into something, you'll pay attention to it. There's a shift in your growth when you start paying attention to things because you're invested in them. Very different than if you just start reading a bunch of books and blogs.
Awesome. Awesome. I love the message there. Like, don't be caught up in fear, but start doing the things that you fear, but do it in a limited way so that you experience it.
Yep. And then you get momentum. And then before you know it, you'll be deep into something and you'll be teaching other people. You got to start with something. And if you don't put money into something, you're not really going to get the same traction. It's just true.
Yeah, makes sense. Awesome. So you said you manage a lot of companies, right? You have your investing side and then you have the EQRP, like your business side of it. How do you, could you share with us, because my show is focused on entrepreneurship and also real estate, could you share with us, like, how do you stay productive doing so much? And so, some tips for our listeners and for myself.
So tips is to learn how to say no. And if you don't know how to say no, then start blocking your calendar with things that you know you need to do. And so one of the things that people do is they spend too much time in meetings. They have too much access for other people. They have a phone number that is available. And because you don't know how to say no, you say yes to everything. It's like a Jim Carrey movie. Remember Yes Men? Say yes to everything. And so being able to turn that stuff off and actually plan and having time where you're thinking and doing whatever it is that really matters. It's a simple concept, but it's really hard for people because we tend to want to be, I mean, I'm like this. I don't want to just not be available to my team and my clients because I actually like them a lot. And it's at the same time, I go, I have the same 24 hours, just like everybody does. And so really controlling your calendar is, I mean, it's critical. And if you work, if you have a job, you've got to say, okay, I'm chewing up 40, 50, 60 hours of my week. Mm-hmm. I only have 10, 20, 30 hours left. So what are the like very purposeful, very conscious planning of your time? People say, well, I just like to be free. Like there, when you have structure, you create freedom. It's a really important thing to think about, because if you don't have any structure, the world just kind of knocks you around, does what it wants. Might seem nice, but you just have to live in a state of hope. Maybe not so, maybe a state of fear too, because what's going to happen tomorrow? So having a plan around your calendar where you actually control it can change your life.
Awesome. Structure. I love the word that you use there, planning out things, keeping that structure. Moving on, like, are there any quotes that you live by?
Probably the thing I've lived by the longest is the idea that mistakes are magic, and that mistakes aren't wrong. We're taught in school that mistakes are bad. And if you make enough mistakes, they kick you out and they say you're a failure and you're going to be a loser. And it's funny, because if you think about school, what are we taught? Make 50% wrong and they kick you out. You're a failure. In the real world, if you make 50% wrong and you got 50% right, I mean, you're a billionaire. I mean, you're worth tens, if not hundreds of millions, if you get 3.5 out of 10 right when you're swinging a bat at a ball. You need to think about that. So learning to really embrace mistakes and saying, okay, I need to make more mistakes faster. That is a key to success and fulfillment, because you're going to learn. Unless you make the same mistake over and over again, then you're an idiot.
Mistakes are magic. That kind of rhymes, M&M. Awesome. Lastly, my show is focused on financial freedom, being your own boss. So what do those terms mean to you? Financial freedom and being your own boss.
I mean, being your own boss, you really choose the outcome. There's a quote, there's a saying that if it's going to be, it's up to me. And that's a good start. Ultimately, it's a great way to burn out. And so there's magic in teams, there's magic in people, because there's synergy that happens. But you know, if you're going to have financial freedom, it's very, very unlikely it's ever going to be from just a job. You've got to be really willing to say, I'm going to be in charge of my life. I'm going to create something. Sometimes you can do it as a part of a team, but you really have to understand there's something that will develop you as a human being by being your own boss more than any college or seminar or anything else. It's a powerful growth program. And so my opinion is everybody should do it. And it's, if you have chatter in your brain thinking, I don't like to sell, or I couldn't do that, or I don't have the skills, you can learn it all. But you got to learn it by doing it.
Very interesting. I have one follow-up question on that. Do you think it's important for someone to find their passion to achieve financial freedom through it, or it doesn't really matter? Like, you figure that as you go.
Passion isn't as important as purpose. I used to think that Aristotle was right. And it's funny, because for a long time I said, the purpose of life is happiness. Aristotle said it. I like that. And I got corrected, and the guy could be wrong, but I said, I actually believe you. He said, the purpose of life is not happiness. It's purpose. People have fallen in love with this idea that you're supposed to be in bliss and you're supposed to be happy. And if you do something you love, that you'll never work a day of your life. There are days where I don't love what I do, but I have a purpose. I have a mission. I know why I'm doing it. There's something that I'm serving, and it's a spiritual mission to break financial bondage. And so it is not about necessarily just being passionate about the things that I'm doing. It's the outcome is worth it. Most people get into trouble because they're so focused on the pleasing methods. Oh, I'm so passionate about this. I love this. And I'm doing that thing. And they're broke and they're homeless, but they're passionate. So it's fun if your passion is also something that the market wants and you happen to be good at. That's the trifecta. The purpose is far more important than the passion.
Awesome. I absolutely loved your insights. Thank you so much for sharing all that with us. Is there anything else you want to talk about on our show? Or let our listeners know how to connect with you.
The best thing you can do if you want to connect with me is check out Financial Underdogs Monday through Friday. It's the show to cut into the real raw truth about money, investing, and financial freedom.
Definitely something I'd love to check out. Financial freedom is what I'm after, and hopefully most of my listeners are as well. So that's great. We will have that on our show notes. Folks, if you love this episode, please do subscribe and leave us a review. I really want to hear what you enjoyed and what your takeaway was. Until next time, stay safe, and we will be back soon.
You've been listening to The Real Path to BYOB. Be your own boss. The 9-to-5, busting your hump for someone else, barely scraping by. With this show, that ins. We hope you've gotten some useful and practical information from this show. And we hope we've helped inspire and give you strategies to maximize your passive wealth through real estate. We'll be back soon. But in the meantime, hook up with us on Instagram at Silicon Hills Capital Group and sign up on our webpage at SiliconHillsCapitalGroup.com to be notified about upcoming webinars and get a copy of the monthly newsletter. You're on track with the real path to BYOB. Be your own boss.